So her talk is called Long-Term Effects of a Health at Every Size Approach versus a Traditional Dieting Intervention on Disordered Eating Among Large Women. So Janelle?
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd also like to thank everybody for coming out today. Looks like I'm starting my presentation prematurely. Let's get back there. I have no relationships to disclose either. I'm going to be talking today about a randomized controlled trial that my colleagues and I conducted, comparing a health at every size intervention to a traditional behavioral weight loss intervention on a number of health outcomes, but today I'm going to be focusing on my disordered eating outcomes. So over the past several decades, we've all been made acutely aware of the current obesity epidemic. And again, I use obesity in quotes, as Natalie had mentioned. The CDC has spent millions in research and public health campaigns, resulting in data-driven maps like those shown here, showing the growing proportions of people with higher BMIs and the related illnesses, as if such elaborate visuals of our nation's changing demographics will somehow contain the magic potion for weight loss. Yes, demands to lose weight are heard loud and clear, but much of the time, public health education aimed at reducing obesity is steeped in powerfully stigmatizing messages and images, which research has shown do not serve as motivating forces, but rather they leave fear, hatred of fat, and internalization of stigma as the ultimate outcome. Data show that experiences of weight-based bullying and victimization from peer and adult perpetrators are commonplace today among children and teens. Consequently, we have a $60 billion weight loss industry where an estimated 75 million American dieters are working on shedding their excess pounds. Yet, evidence shows that dieting is not only ineffective, but the resulting weight cycling may actually be more harmful to cardiovascular health in the long run than remaining at a high but stable weight. Not to mention what yo-yo dieting does to one's psychological health, putting people, particularly young women, at risk for life-threatening eating disorders. So amidst a culture obsessed with weight loss, evidence calls for a paradigm shift in the public health campaign against obesity. And the data that we're presenting today as part of this afternoon's panel underscores the need for the implementation of a weight-neutral approach in healthcare, one that promotes self-care behaviors and well-being for everyone, regardless of their body size. So my objectives today are threefold, and first I'll briefly review the underlying principles of the weight-neutral approach, which is often termed as the health at every size paradigm, HAES for short. Then I'm going to present my long-term findings of a randomized controlled trial comparing the HAES program to traditional weight loss on specifically disordered eating outcomes. And lastly, I'm going to consider internalization of weight stigma as a potential moderating variable of those outcomes. So as a preface to the HAES principles, and for those of you who didn't get a brochure of the Association for Size, Diversity, and Health, please come up and obtain one, because this will explain in greater detail the principles that I don't have great amounts of time to discuss with you. But as a preface, I would like to say a few words about the standard lifestyle change approach that we see embraced by mainstream medical and public health communities. And I'd like to say that it certainly includes many aspects of promotion for all sizes, like engaging in physical activity and building supportive relationships, adopting positive attitudes, and making good nutritious decisions. But until we remove the goal of weight loss from this equation, the harmful effects of this dominant medical model are going to remain. So here's the principles. There are five, and as I said, I'm not going to go into them in detail. There is a handout that's been uploaded to the presentation, so please also refer to the handout to get some more information. The Association for Size, Diversity, and Health has trademarked the health at every size paradigm and the principles that go along with it. This framing came out of discussions among healthcare workers, along with researchers and consumers, who specifically reject the use of weight, size, or BMI as a proxy for health, and the myth that weight is purely a choice. So I'm going to discuss Now my randomized controlled trial, and as I said before, we had an experimental treatment that involved a health at every size approach. We had two treatments, in fact, a control treatment involving a behavioral weight loss intervention. These were 6 months in length, and they involved 90-minute sessions led by a trained group facilitator. All of our measurements took place at study entry prior to the beginning of the intervention, again at 6 months post-intervention, and finally at a 24-month follow-up point. The study participants were recruited through local advertisements, newspapers, flyers that you see here hung in doctor's offices and the hospital website. Our participants were 80 obese women between the ages of 30 and 45. They were primarily white, middle-class, employed, married women with children. Approximately two-thirds of them had some college education, and they had a mean BMI of 38. The experimental approach, as I said, followed a Hays-oriented weight-neutral framework, and this means that the curriculum was adopted from an evidence-based treatment titled the HUGS program, which was developed by Linda Omachinsky, who's a dietitian from Canada. Participants received a book of handouts and worksheets, a cookbook titled Tailoring Your Tastes, and a book called Staying Off the Diet Roller Coaster. And they also received a set of affirmation CDs produced by HUGS Incorporated. A psychotherapist and fitness professional delivered the intervention in weekly meetings of groups of 20 for a period, as I said, of 6 months, following the model of healthy living that you see shown here. The control intervention utilized was titled the LEARN program for weight management, and some of you may have heard of this. It's an evidence-based behavior modification approach to weight loss, and it was developed by psychologist Dr. Kelly Brunell, which many of us know received a Lifetime Achievement Award yesterday at the meetings. It's also a manualized curriculum sharing actually many common principles with our HUGS curriculum. Both emphasize the importance of healthy lifestyle choices with gradual sustainable change. However, the LEARN program made weight loss an explicit goal and focused more on food intake based on externally prescribed meal plans in order to achieve calorie reduction. So participants in the behavioral weight loss condition received the LEARN program for weight management, the weight maintenance guide, as well as a LEARN program CD set. We had a registered dietitian from the weight management center at the hospital where the study took place offer this intervention, also in groups of 20, for a period of 6 months, the same 6 months that we had the other program take place. So our outcomes were obtained by performing structured interviews with our study participants, and we measured disordered eating and body image concerns through the eating disorder examination questionnaire and the three-factor eating questionnaire. And both we considered all the subscales that were inherent in these questionnaires as well. So here's a flowchart of our analysis. We maintained 90% of our participants at the 6 month follow-up and 50% by the 24-month follow-up. However, by using linear mixed models for the data analysis, we are able to utilize all of the data collected during the trial as opposed to limiting it to only those for whom we had information at all three time points, as would be the case if we were to do a standard repeated measures analysis. So what were our results? In terms of global disordered eating, as you can see here, Hays participants in the red saw sharp declines in disordered eating patterns, whereas the LEARN participants essentially saw no improvements through the intervention or during the long-term follow-up. So I wanted to check out what was going on in the subscales of this particular global measure. And here we can see a slightly different picture. And the good news is that on average, whether you're a part of the behavioral weight loss group or the Hays group, at least during the short term, everyone's getting some benefit. We can see in red, again, the sharper declines in symptomatology is coming from the people taking part in the Hays program. But the people in the behavioral weight loss program are also seeing some reductions in weight and shape concerns as well as eating concerns, at least by the long-term follow-up. The real story comes here in the restraint subscale. And what's evident is that we had, as you can see in the blue line, large increases in weight loss participants on restraint behaviors from baseline to post-intervention, and this increase is maintained during the 24-month follow-up period. Hayes participants had no changes during either the baseline or the 24-month follow-up in restraint behaviors. And providing validation for these results, we can see the same pattern of changes occurs for the cognitive restraint scale from the three-factor eating questionnaire. We see, again, weight loss folks demonstrating a sharp incline after the intervention and Hayes staying relatively static. So more importantly, though, what are the implications of women with high BMIs endorsing significantly greater restraint? So here's a sample of a more benign and a more pathological item from the eating disorder examination questionnaire. And I'm certain no one here would argue that skipping meals to lose weight is advisable or healthy. Furthermore, restraint theory tells us that when people constantly limit their food intake or never give in, as endorsement of the second item here would suggest, this is part of the cognitive restraint scale from the three-factor eating questionnaire, they want what they cannot have even more. And ultimately, diets often begin to fail and binging is more likely to occur. And in fact, a recent longitudinal study demonstrated that dietary restraint also led to higher perceived burdens of negative life events. So we actually have a long history of dietary restraint in the literature predicting negative eating outcomes and weight outcomes as well, and our data tell a similar story. So what's happening here with binge episodes? We can see that both interventions conferred significant benefits during the first 6 months. However, at long-term follow-up, it was our behavioral weight loss folks who started to see recidivism rates in their binge eating behaviors, whereas the Health at Every Size folks continued to improve. And these results are repeated for both the uncontrolled eating and the emotional eating subscale, again, offering validity and consistency to our findings. So in my last few minutes, where does internalization of weight bias fit into this picture? So my hypothesis was that individuals who came to our study with higher degrees of internalized weight bias would be more resistant to improvement in disordered eating outcomes, and this graph shows precisely that. So we can see here in the bluish line that the people with high degrees of internalization do not enjoy any improvements throughout the intervention in these outcomes, whereas the people with lower degrees of internalized stigma actually are improving significantly and do manage to maintain those improvements during the follow-up period. So I wanted to see what would happen to this effect when I parsed things out looking at the interventions in particular. And you can see that here in the red and the blue lines, we have the LEARN program participants. Really, internalization of weight bias doesn't make much of a difference here. People in the LEARN program, that's the behavioral weight loss, didn't change across the board, and I saw that earlier in the results. The people in blue who have high internalized weight bias maintain high disordered eating behaviors throughout the intervention and during follow-up. The people who have lower internalized weight bias have lower disordered eating behaviors throughout the intervention and during the long-term follow-up. The Hayes study, we see a significant difference, though. Now, both groups, whether you're high or low in internalized weight bias, do manage to see improvements in disordered eating behaviors. But what's happening here is the people who are low in internalized weight bias are able to improve much, much greater, and they're able to maintain those improvements. Where if you have these high degrees of internalized weight bias, we have improvement, but we have high recidivism rates for these individuals. So in summary, we look at the brighter side of these results and we see that traditional lifestyle approaches like the LEARN program are not evidencing entirely harmful outcomes. In fact, the behavioral weight loss program participants received many good qualities with our weight neutral Hayes program, and this was our intent and hope. However, our improvements in binging and other disordered eating attitudes that occurred for the LEARN program participants occurred with significant increases in pathological eating behaviors measured by both restraint scales, and consequently, many of these gains were not enjoyed in the long term. For Hayes participants, On the other hand, as I showed you, all of our improvements were maintained during the long-term follow-up. Finally, with respect to weight bias internalization, it is an important modifier of treatment outcomes, particularly for those in a Health at Every Size program. And this suggests that simply avoiding a focus on weight loss may not fulfill the needs of those who have high degrees of internalized weight stigma. So specific attention needs to be paid to building supportive, size-accepting environments and countering our negative cultural messages towards larger size individuals. So I'll stop there. For health and well-being, regardless of size, we're going to reject our focus on the scale and focus on intuitive eating and movement for everyone. Here's a list of Health at Every Size resources. And I'd like to say many thanks to my sponsor, the Edna G. Carnett Memorial Foundation, my collaborators, supporters, participants, and co-panelists. Thanks for your attention.